How many babies was made to that song?
Well, that's the end of the program, I'm afraid. That was Matt Valentine just there from Space Shanties doing Sky Ain't High. Sorry I had to fade it a little early. We heard Celebrity Handshake doing Planet 12 from their Counterfeit Head. We heard the second, the ending of Chicago's Feeling Stronger Every Day. We heard Tissue Witch doing Too Afraid to Love You from their Walt Whitman EP. Harmonia from their great collection of demos and stuff called Documents 1975. It was Tiki Taka at Harmonia Studio in Forst. Hall & Oates from a 7-inch leftover from Singles Going Steady a couple weeks ago. One on One from 1982. The Black Vial did Pak Naksa from their Noise Frequency PWM LP. And a couple Welsh bands at the top of the set. Ikurf with Anadl from their Ikurf EP. And Igwefrau from their 12-inch EP of 1990, a track called Get Down 90. That's everything we heard. My name's Scott. Look forward to seeing you next week, but even before that, at the Record Fair this Saturday and Sunday, friends. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM, worldwide online at WFMU.org. Stay tuned. Mark Hurst and Tectonic is coming right your way.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Great to be with you, thanks so much for spending some time with me. I've got a great interview to share with you today. I'm going to be speaking with Aram Sinreich, who's the co-author of a book I liked a lot. It's called The Secret Life of Data, Navigating Hype and Uncertainty in the Age of Algorithmic Surveillance. It's published by MIT Press. And he wrote it with Jesse Gilbert. This book, as the title suggests, has something to say about data that is secret, that is beyond your awareness. And that's why I found this such an important message to amplify and pass along and discuss to you, because we live in a surveillance state. It's not being built. It's not on its way. The surveillance state is here, and we are in it, and it is inescapable. I mean, wherever you go, there is surveillance of you. There is data being captured and recorded and analyzed about you. And that data then goes to data centers where it is analyzed and combined and cross-referenced with other data, which then completes the feedback loop by creating yet more data in the ways that your environment changes as a result of what the machines have learned about you. Could be advertising, or could be much more sinister ways in which the surveillance state changes your life, your work, your relationships, or your opportunities based on the data that the state has gained about you and its analysis. Correct or not, it may be making incorrect assumptions or conclusions about you, doesn't matter. We are in it at this point. And a lot of this stuff is happening well beyond our awareness. I think this book does a great job in beginning to dispel that fog to some extent so that we gain some awareness. But even so, we are in this surveillance state and being tracked and manipulated in ways that we're not aware of, which I think is where Aram and Jesse were headed with this idea of the secret life of data, that the data is being recorded and the data multiplies as it turns into other data of analysis and metadata, which we'll all get into. So this is a really important conversation. I found it enjoyable to speak with Aram, and you're gonna get some good examples. But most importantly, I think this is something that you need to know about. As this surveillance state, while it's already here, it does continue to metastasize in the continuing partnership between the toxic big tech illegal monopolies and their close government partners. If you would like a link to the book and some other resources, you can find it at tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. I'm going to say a little more about the website later in the show, but go ahead and take a look, tectonic.fm. And in the meantime, let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Aram Sinreich, co-author of The Secret Life of Data, here on Tectonic. Aram Sinreich, welcome to Tectonic.
Thank you so much, Mark.
I appreciated how in your book, The Secret Life of Data, you're trying to express all the types of data in our lives, all the kinds of influence that data has on us, both individually and as a society. I wanted to start with something you write early on in the book, referencing the title of the book, The Secret Life of Data. You write, "There is no limit to the amount and variety of data, and ultimately knowledge, that may be produced from an object, event, or interaction given enough time, distance, and computational power." I took that as a kind of working definition of this secret life of data, but say more about that, how data is just multiplying everywhere.
Sure. Well, you've really hit at the heart of the whole book. And this was the idea that my co-author Jesse Gilbert and I wanted to popularize when we wrote the book. When we talk about data, we tend to think of it as existing in these little discrete silos or quanta. You go to a website and you get a little pop-up that says, like, are you okay sharing, you know, your browsing data with us? And you go to the doctor's office and you have to check a little box saying they're allowed to store the data about your medical tests. But we don't really get a chance to think comprehensively, not only about how much data is being collected across all of these different points of contact that we go through in our daily lives and in our professional lives, but also we don't get a chance to think about what uses those data are going to be put to next, right? Once you've given the website your cookie data, and once you've given your doctor your medical data, and once you've given your bank your financial data, it doesn't really end there. It gets put into a database, and those databases get combined with other databases, and those companies get bought by other companies, and those other companies get hacked by international criminal rings, and those international criminal rings get their assets seized by governments, and those data just continue to proliferate and get combined and recombined and get put to all kinds of new uses that nobody, including the people who are collecting it, could ever anticipate in advance. And those new uses have all kinds of weird downstream consequences that mess with our cultures, that mess with our democracies, that mess with our social norms in all kinds of unpredictable ways that make it really difficult to exert any kind of control as the data subject whose data is being extracted.
I want to reference a couple of examples that you give. You write, whatever we think we're sharing when we upload a selfie, write an email, shop online, stream a video, look up driving directions, track our sleep, or like a post, that's only the tip of the proverbial iceberg. Both the artifacts that we produce intentionally and the data traces we leave in our wake as we go about our daily lives can and likely will be recorded, archived, analyzed, combined, and cross-referenced with other data and used to generate new forms of knowledge without our awareness or consent. I just want to note here in passing that without our knowledge or consent, or without our awareness or consent, that phrase comes up again and again in this book. There's so much happening without our knowledge or consent.
Yeah, Jesse and I actually talked about that while we were writing the book. Like, is it too much? Should we keep reminding people that this is happening without our knowledge and consent? And believe it or not, we cut a fair number of instances of that phrase out of the manuscript because it just felt like too much. But we wanted to keep reminding our readers that, you know, none of this is precedented and none of it is done with the awareness of any of the people who are affected by it. And, you know, that is a kind of social power that we have never seen in the history of humankind. That kind of knowledge, that kind of totalizing awareness of what's going on within and around every individual human being on the planet at every time of day and night.
And we're going to get to the surveillance aspects of this in a second. Well, first, I just want to say another phrase that came up, and I circled it. It was either two or three times in the book, was tectonic shift. And I appreciated that. A little shout out to the show.
That was for you.
But let's talk about metadata, because right after this introduction where you're defining the secret life of data, you go in to talk about this idea of data proliferating as it's stored, as it's collected, as it's analyzed, how data begets more data. In fact, you have that phrase in the book, metadata beget more metadata ad infinitum, because the act of cataloging creates more categories of knowledge. Even a lone digital file can generate multiple overlapping and potentially contradictory layers of information when placed in new contexts. Okay, so Aram, for listeners who are not familiar with metadata, can you describe some examples of how metadata proliferates and makes new categories of knowledge in these ways?
Sure. Well, as we talk about in the book, metadata really began in the world of libraries, where back in, you know, ancient times, when the Library of Alexandria, for instance, was being built, they amassed 500,000 books, or what were back then scrolls, and they had to kind of figure out, how are we going to organize these things? If somebody wants a piece of information, how are they going to find it? So they developed all these new techniques like alphabetization, and they hung little tags at the end of the scrolls so that you would know what was in the scroll, and genrefication. They'd put all the poetry in one room and they'd put all the medical textbooks in another room. And, you know, we kind of take that for granted. But if you think about it, what's written on those little tags is separate than what's actually in the scroll itself. It's data about data, and that's why we call it metadata. But we've undergone a shift during our lifetimes where metadata is no longer about books or about movies or about music or what have you. It's actually about us. So every time we go to a website, that website is collecting metadata about what we do. Every time we open an app on our phone, that app is tracking things like, you know, how long you looked at a particular image, or whether in cases of apps like TikTok, like where your eyes were looking and how long they lingered on that particular spot on the screen, which buttons we pressed and which buttons we didn't press, who we interacted with and at what time. And all of those metadata are kept in these very well-organized databases, and they never go away. So, you know, every single interaction you've ever had with Amazon is sitting in a file associated with all of your personally identifiable information. And, you know, when Amazon inevitably turns into another company, it'll get absorbed into that other company and recombined with all the metadata that they've already collected on you. And what we're essentially doing is creating these massive dossiers on every person, place, and thing on the planet. And those dossiers themselves become so large that they require metadata to be made about them. And that's what we meant by ad infinitum. We really could have written ad nauseum. Because it's, I think about, the, you know, that scene in the Harry Potter series where they sneak into the vault at Gringotts and it's got some kind of magical ward on it. So if you touch an object, that object becomes like two versions of itself. And before long, they're like drowning in goblets. Metadata really works that way. Like every interaction you have begets more and more metadata until, you know, the amount of information about your action or interaction drastically outnumbers like the amount of information that was transacted in the first place.
Some people upon hearing this might think, well, how can I do anything without being tracked or leaving some data trail? And you're right that that's pretty much impossible now, the way the technology is designed. You bring up something called Locard's exchange principle, named after a pioneer of forensic science named Edmond Locard, who had this phrase, every contact leaves a trace. And you follow that up by reminding the readers, in the digital world, every virtual contact leaves a trace. Probably my favorite example that you give in this section is about the metadata embedded in a digital image file, the EXIF data, E-X-I-F data, that is embedded in a, let's say, a JPEG or a PNG. Here's what you write. Today, photos taken by many popular mobile devices, such as the iPhone, include geotagging information by default in their EXIF headers. This means that unless you've disabled this setting, every time you share a selfie via social media, text, or email, you're also sharing your precise GPS location at the time you took the photo. And I don't think many people understand that.
No, and that's part of what Jesse and I are trying to critique, is that these tools are placed in our hands without our being adequately informed by the companies that manufacture them about what they're capable of doing. I mean, Apple's basically been using the camera feature of the iPhones to sell the device, you know, its best-selling device for over a decade. I don't know about you, but like every time I've driven under the Lincoln Tunnel since 2010 or something like that, there's a giant advertisement showing you how great the latest iPhone's cameras are. And at no point does it ever say, by the way, every time you take a picture, you are telling us and anyone you share it with exactly where on the planet you are and when.
Oh, to the contrary, Aram, the billboard says privacy, that's Apple. And you're looking up at this billboard with these larger than life surveillance cameras.
100%. The irony of Apple's pivot to privacy branding in 2019 has not been lost on people who follow tech really closely. Actually, I recently, for reasons, had to go through a kind of history of all of Apple's most egregious breaches of consumer privacy, and they are legion, and they are severe. And I don't mean to pick on Apple. I mean, Google and Amazon and Microsoft and the rest of these tech companies are just as bad or worse. But there are reasons for this, right? One is that the metadata, you might think to yourself, like, what does Apple care whether I was like in, you know, Toledo, Ohio, or San Francisco on a given day of the year? And the answer is they don't. But the data are much more valuable in aggregate than they are individually, because you can start to see patterns emerge. You can learn a lot about a person just from where they go. I mean, you can think of, you know, it's not just Toledo versus San Francisco. It's the abortion clinic or the cancer treatment center or the church or the mosque or the synagogue. And they're able to, they being anybody with possession of the metadata, is able to construct a really, really detailed, intimate profile of you just based on those data points alone.
All right, so let's talk a little bit more about surveillance explicitly. You have a great chapter called Our Devices Are Smart, But Are We? This is something that I have said for years on this show, that we need to retire the term smart and just replace it with the word surveillance. So if you have a smart fridge, nope, it's a surveillance fridge. And in all seriousness, we should be calling them surveillance phones, because it's not smart to be surveilled. It's nightmarish. Anyway, they're surveillance phones. And in fact, I was happy that you said let's be clear about this. Smart devices are, by definition and by design, surveillance devices. Thank you, Aram. I feel validated. But here in this chapter, you're talking about the Internet of Things, which is this vast network of all of the smart/surveillance devices, you know, the fridges, the surveillance doorbells, and the spy devices on your kitchen counter that respond to Alexa or Google or whatever.
You're missing a whole category of smart devices in the Internet of Things, which is all of the non-consumer facing objects that are still collecting data about us and sharing them to centralized databases. So think about traffic cameras. Think about the card readers that you have to swipe when you go into the gym or into your place of business. Think about EasyPass. So we all day long are even when we're not consciously interacting with a device that we've chosen to welcome into our lives, we are leaking data into these cyber physical systems that are dotted around our physical landscape in a way that makes the physical world more and more like the internet in terms of its trackability.
Yes. And you also talk about the data broker business, these giant companies that most people are unable to name, maybe not even aware of, that collect all of this data, collate it, analyze it, and are putting together those dossiers that you talk about. And people could ask, well, why is it so bad if some random data broker has the collated data of my EasyPass and Alexa spying on my audio in my kitchen, my fridge, and everything else? You write that law enforcement increasingly targets individuals using these commercial surveillance methods in order to sidestep the legal or logistical obstacles that are supposed to rein them in. So here, one threat to us in a democracy is that all of the expectations around due process and warrants and so on, that can be all sidestepped if law enforcement goes to a commercial data broker and pulls a dossier there. Am I reading that right?
Yes, there are actually two different flavors of that risk. One of them is that law enforcement will frequently go to tech companies and use these kind of blanket warrants to just say, we want information about anybody who's in 100 feet of this area between 2 and 6 p.m. because we think something bad happened there. And organizations like the ACLU have been fighting really hard to make those kinds of blanket warrants less legal. But they, to the best of my understanding, they are still very, very commonly used. But there's also the fact that even if there's no warrant outstanding, even a blanket warrant, these data, are, as you mentioned, are being sold in the open marketplace by data brokers, and there's no law prohibiting law enforcement or any government agency or any third party whatsoever from buying tranches of this data. One of the things that Jesse and I did in the book is we actually used a free service by one of the many location-based data brokers on the internet, and we were able to trace the locations of every individual who visited Mar-a-Lago during the last year of Trump's first term. And we saw like, oh, this person came from this particular apartment building in the Ukraine, and that person came from that particular apartment building in Argentina. And we were able to very easily, especially for, you know, we're not forensic data scientists, we were able to re-identify those data points, and we were able to say, okay, well, this person is a Nigerian preacher who held a pro-Trump rally and then got invited to Mar-a-Lago a couple weeks later, and it was never announced to the public that Trump had interacted with this person. So obviously, we are ethical scholars who are bound by codes, and, you know, we conduct our research in a very transparent way. But any other person or organization that might have more nefarious purposes can collect the same kinds of data and a lot more of it if they're willing to pony up for a paid version of these data brokers. And that means that, there's really nobody who's untouchable and untraceable, even the president of the United States.
Yeah, I was really struck by that case study. You're writing that you and Jesse were able to pull down that information in a matter of minutes. And this was using the free version of the tool.
Yeah.
You didn't even have to pay the $5.
Well, it's a lot more than $5. I mean, the pro versions of the tools cost thousands of dollars per month. One of the things that's happened since Jesse and I did that, I think we did that in 2021 or 2022, is that the Biden FTC actually started to get concerned about the privacy and national security implications of these platforms. So they started to investigate them. And what the platforms did is they actually removed the free versions, and then they won't even post accurate information about what data points they offer or what price points they offer them at. You have to schedule a phone call with a salesperson to get into the database. So we were going to do a follow-up project with the ACLU of Massachusetts, and we were unable to do that follow-up because we couldn't even figure out what our budget was going to be, because none of the salespeople would talk to us after we had published this case study.
In your conclusion for this chapter, you bring up a perspective that I think is both chilling, but also very important for people to understand. Because here we're describing really the rise of a surveillance state, a government that through data brokers or blanket warrants to big tech companies can gather whatever data they need on anybody in the country or visiting the country for any reason. And maybe a few years ago, people might have said, well, it's concerning that the government has all this power, but I trust the government not to misuse it. I feel like things have unfortunately changed. They were never great, but they have accelerated in a downward direction rapidly with the ICE raids and the kidnappings and masked men and so on. And so that sets up this comment that I thought was so important. You write, in the former Eastern Bloc nations, secret police notoriously tapped phones and tailed pedestrians, but each spy could only listen to only so many hours of conversation and tail only one person at a time. Today, with minimal expenditure, expertise, and effort, any police officer, advertiser, spurned lover, or potential blackmailer can collect far more detailed information about an individual or an entire city. And I think what you're pointing out here is that the scale of what's possible is so much bigger. It's unthinkably bigger than even what the Stasi had at the height of the Cold War.
Yes, that's correct. And you might say to yourself, well, that's all well and good. They can collect as much data as they want. But at the end of the day, like, a human being's got to go through the data and look for the patterns. But of course, that's not true anymore either, because thanks to generative AI platforms like ChatGPT, you can feed it a year's worth of data about somebody and ask for it to assemble a dossier about the most suspicious things they've done. And it'll do that inside of 10 seconds. So if for instance, you were an authoritarian leader of a government who is looking to persecute their enemies and come up with, you know, the most plausible reasons to arrest or investigate them, ChatGPT plus widespread data surveillance would be the perfect combination, much more effective than getting the Stasi to, you know, point a camera into your bedroom window and hope that you had an illicit affair.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with Aram Sinrich, co-author of the book, The Secret Life of Data, published by MIT Press and written with Jesse Gilbert. You're hearing our conversation covering some of the really interesting examples in the book, like the EXIF data that is probably on by default if you use a surveillance phone camera. The idea of smart devices actually being surveillance devices, and the unfortunate reality of the dossier that is being built on you based on the surveillance data that is recorded and analyzed and collated beyond your awareness or consent. On that happy note, Let's go ahead. I really did enjoy this interview. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Aram Sinrich, co-author of The Secret Life of Data, here on Tectonic. Okay, now let me bring this down to an individual level, a consumer level, because later in the book you talk about something called Facebook's Project Aria, which you'll have to correct me on this. I think this is the project that has morphed into the surveillance glasses they're doing with Ray-Ban, or at least it's related to it. But Project Aria was having people wear surveillance glasses in public all over the world to beta test the platform and let Facebook engineers work with it a bit. You write a complaint that I feel all the time in New York City, and not just because of Facebook's stupid surveillance glasses. You write, "Our bodies and identities are caught in the dragnet of Project Aria's omnivorous surveillance process. Continuous real-time data about us becomes a corporation's private property every time we step out of our homes." And I feel that myself. I've covered this on multiple shows. I live in Manhattan, and anytime I walk down Broadway, I have to pass by multiple Link NYC surveillance kiosks, which have three cameras. The whole thing is run by Google, and it's capturing, who knows, my face, my gait, the time and location of where I was, and it's everywhere. And that's just the 9-foot-tall kiosks that you can see. That doesn't even count all the surveillance sensors that the government and big tech have larded down the streetscape with that you can't see.
Yeah, that's all true. And I don't mean to add extra concern on top of it. But remember that you talked about face recognition and gait recognition, and those are today technologies. But one of the weird things about the secret life of data is that if you hang on to data that you've collected long enough, new technologies and new forensic abilities will emerge that will allow people and organizations to re-mine old data to find new things about you. For instance, you could easily imagine 10 years down the line, some kind of AI that analyzes passersby for their medical conditions. And then you could get all of that Link NYC data, which right now is probably not trying to pathologize you and figure out what your medical status is, but you could go back and you could say, oh, you know, these are people who have this medical condition, and that, then you could actually monetize that or follow up on it. We now have the Department of Health that is essentially eugenicist, and where officials have openly talked about, you know, killing disabled people, or at least deprioritizing them in the medical system and letting them die rather than trying to preserve their lives and dignity. You could imagine how that those kinds of data would be weaponized in retrospect by a Department of Health like that. That's just one of an infinite number of examples. But the point being that these kiosks are really collecting, in addition to the structured data that you're talking about, oh, this is that person, this is the IP address of that person's phone, they're also collecting what's known as unstructured data, which means they haven't really fully processed it to figure out what's in it yet. And you can go back to the well over and over and over and over again. One can imagine, you know, 20 years or 50 years or 100 years in the future, some kind of virtual reality that reproduces New York City on a given day, and you can walk around in the New York City that's been captured by Link NYC, and you can run into Mark Hurst and you can ask him questions about himself and his life, and virtual Mark Hurst will answer them based on all of the different databases that have collected information about your browsing habits and your shopping habits and your medical history and your financial history and your educational history, and you can become a toy in somebody else's virtual paradise forever.
I have enough nightmares, Aram. Why did you add this one?
You know, Jesse and I, would, when we were writing this book, we'd sometimes just look at each other and be like, are you sleeping, man? No, I'm not. Like, this is not okay. Like, the deeper we got into it, the more dystopian it seemed. And it really sucks being Cassandra and having to tell everybody all the time how bad things are, because you don't want to be a Debbie Downer, and nobody listens to you anyway. Which is why we worked really hard not just to make the book a compendium of like nightmarish technologies and scenarios, but to try to actually empower readers to make a difference in how the tech was being used and regulated.
And I want to get to the more positive angle here, but I just, before we leave this topic of unstructured data, I just wanted to add that I appreciated that you spoke to Dennis Crowley, the founder of a company called Foursquare. People may remember this from years ago when people would go to a bar or restaurant and pull out their surveillance phone and start the Foursquare app and then check in to that venue. And if you checked in enough times, you could become the mayor. It was very cute. But really, it was an app for you to share your own location surveillance data with this company. Anyway, you spoke to Dennis. This is now years later. And what I took away from this interview was basically he said, yeah, we always wanted to capture as much data as we could, even if we didn't know what we were going to do with it, because at some point it might turn out to be valuable. In other words, there was no sense that they should minimize their data collection.
Beyond that, and first of all, let me say that Dennis is somebody I've known since the 1990s. We used to work together. He is as ethical as you get in this line of business. And he was like very keen to point out, there are a lot of much scuzzier, less ethical data brokers out there who are not opt-in based, who are doing a lot worse things with your data. So I don't want to point to him as some kind of villain or something. He's actually a very smart guy who got into this because he really believed in online sociality before almost anyone else on the planet did. I mean, I was one of the beta testers for Dodgeball, which was the precursor to Foursquare. One day he just coded it, and then he came and told us, like, you have profiles on this site. Now we can all meet up at bars. This is like circa 1998, 1999.
I remember Dodgeball, sure.
Yeah, so Dennis is really cool and really smart. And his point was not like, oh, we're just going to try to maximally exploit you. His point was twofold. One is that data storage gets cheaper every year thanks to Moore's Law. So the cost of holding on to data versus the benefit of that data's long-term economic upside is minimal. The more data you collect, the longer you collect it, the cheaper it gets to store it, and the more valuable it becomes down the line as an asset in the marketplace. But beyond that, companies like Foursquare have a fiduciary duty to maximize the value of the data that they collect. Facebook, Google, Amazon, all of these companies, if they don't maximally exploit those data in the market, if they don't hold on to things that may be valuable down the line, they are doing a disservice to their shareholders, and they could actually be liable for that and be found to have violated their duties as the custodians of these data-oriented companies. And that's going to be the situation as long as we don't have meaningful data privacy regulations that change the value proposition for these companies.
Okay, let's shift to how the data, the secret life of data, is affecting us and what we can do about it. You have a chapter called The Overexamined Life, which is talking about how, if we're not careful, we can abdicate our responsibility or our agency in favor of an algorithm and, by extension, the agenda of the company behind the algorithm. You write, the moment we change our behaviors and appearances to serve the dictates of an algorithm, we subvert our own needs and desires to suit the values of whoever has designed or programmed it. Talk to me about the risk we face. What is an example of how someone might change their behavior or appearance to satisfy an algorithm? And the flip side, the good news, what can we do to guard against that?
Sure. There are all kinds of examples, large and small. And Jesse and I group them under a term that we call algovision, which is when you start to kind of see yourself through the eyes of the algorithm. You know, the classic example that every single one of us has seen in our lives, if we don't do it ourselves, like I will be FaceTiming with my sister, and all of a sudden she'll start shaking her arm violently in front of the camera. And At first I was like, what are you doing? Like, did you have pins and needles or something? Did your arm go to sleep? And she's like, no, I've, you know, my watch is telling me it's time to stand up, but I don't want to stand up because I'm talking to you. So I'm just going to shake my arm and tell the watch that I'm standing up. So now that tens of millions of Americans are wearing smart watches and smart rings and other kinds of biomedical surveillance devices, we are essentially being having our physical activity regulated by these faceless corporations based on these algorithms and standards that have nothing to do with us as individuals. And, you know, we're being told when to drink water, when to go to bed, when to do exercise, when to stand up, when to sit down, how many steps to take, you know, and phrases like got to get my steps in have become, you know, normative tropes in American popular culture. So that's kind of the low-hanging stuff. But then you think about the kind of next level where people, you know, for instance, during the COVID pandemic, plastic surgery skyrocketed. And the reason for that was that so many people saw their faces on Zoom all day and they just didn't like what they saw. So they began to internalize, you know, like, well, I want to look what I look like after I click the filter button, not before I click it. And so they go to plastic surgeons and say, make my face look filtered, you know, make it look smoother, like get rid of these pouches under my eyes and this bag under my chin. And even beyond that, you start to think about, you know, people who are maybe more vulnerable, who maybe have undocumented status or are seeking an abortion in a state where that's now illegal. And they may completely change their habits in order to convince some omniscient algorithm that they're only dimly aware of that they're not a person of interest. And that might involve driving a different route to school or to work, or it might involve not going to the grocery store, or it might involve censoring what you say on social media. And, you know, that level of internalization becomes really fascistic and deprives people of the basic dignity that all human beings should have to live their lives according to their own principles and values.
Yeah, what immediately comes to mind, again, is these ridiculous Facebook surveillance glasses. The news just came out that you can, for $60, you can buy a little mod kit to get around the feature of an LED light showing when you're recording. In other words, you can pay a little bit and you can record people without their knowledge or consent without the LED light showing. The reason I think that bears on this part of our conversation here, Aram, is that now, anytime you're in public, if you see someone wearing Ray-Ban glasses, it doesn't matter if the light is on or off, you can just assume that you are being recorded and that footage can and will be posted in a social media forum and then, of course, sent to Facebook for storage and analysis forever. And I wonder what kind of chilling effect that has. What is the algo vision for that? When we're now in public and we have to watch what we say because it's liable to be shared on social media.
I mean, you make an excellent point. We are now presumptively surveilled everywhere we go and everything that we do, whether it's online or in the physical world. But the good news is that AlgoVision actually also gives us a kind of superpower, right? Because once we begin to assume individually and collectively that we are surrounded by surveillance devices, we develop these kinds of resilient practices that fool surveillance or that make surveillance more difficult. And it could be obvious stuff like, you know, popularizing surveillance blocking makeup. I have a 15-year-old who went to a No Kings rally in Washington, D.C., and they looked up surveillance blocking makeup online and they painted their face and went out to the rally with that. But a lot of it is more subtle than that. You know, the journalist Taylor Lorenz a couple of years ago published an article about what she called algo speak, which is, you know, how people change the way that they actually, the language that they use when they communicate on platforms that have built-in surveillance and censorship. For instance, a platform that would block the word dead, they would say unalive, right? And these coping mechanisms, what my friends and colleagues, Dana Boyd and Alice Marwick, many years ago called social steganography, are kind of, that's how human beings deal with authority and with power. Like, we're always looking for escape routes. We're always looking to kind of change things up. And the reality is that culture moves faster than technology does. And so I think, you know, we're never going to live in a 100% totalizing, fascistic, techno-surveillance state, because there's always going to be an exploit or an out or a new twist that the designers of these surveillance mechanisms hadn't previously accounted for that's going to give people an edge to carve out spaces of dignity and agency. Now, you could ask the question, is that how you want to spend your life? Looking for a way to be free in a more and more enclosed system? And obviously the answer is no. But also, I think the thing we have to remember when we talk about tech and when we talk about authoritarianism is that these are self-limiting systems. We're never going to live in Elon Musk's fantasy world where he owns everybody's brains and pipes whatever garbage he wants, you know, Nazi bullshit into our brains, you know, using his computer chips. These systems are environmentally not sustainable. They're economically not sustainable. These companies are always in danger of folding. Even super wealthy companies like Apple and Google that have, you know, trillions of dollars in their market caps, they're short-lived. They're not going to be around in 100 years. And I think that we're living through a moment in which this new kind of social power has emerged, and it's really consolidated into the hands of a few very horrible people. But ultimately, I think that the human will to live lives of joy and communion will prevail over the longer term. I just hope I live to see it.
I hope so, too. And I hope you're right about this, Aram, because I know you're reaching for an optimistic look, but a lot of things have to go right in order for us to free ourselves of these systems, both societally and individually. As you write in the conclusion, we are woefully underprepared for a future in which global-scale sensor nets, biometric implants, AI-derived predictive models, deepfakes, chatbots, malware, and so on are permeating our bodies and public spheres and businesses and political institutions. And I agree with you. We are underprepared. I mean, I think that's part of the role of this book is to raise some awareness, as it is for this show. But we, I feel like collectively, we have to take on the responsibility to learn more about what's happening and to put in the work to extract ourselves as much as we can from these systems and advocate for a better governmental response, better than the practically zero that we're getting right now.
100%. Awareness is the first step toward liberation. And that is the purpose of our book, just like it's the purpose of your show. These concepts are made obscure for a reason. Policy is laden down with jargon that nobody understands. Tech is not only jargon laden, but also tends to be, you know, black box and closed source, so that even people with expertise don't have access to really understand it. And, you know, you can see how companies like Meta have gone after researchers who have tried to open up the black box a little bit, or X for that matter. Our aim is really to get everyday people who are not chronically online like we are some basic, not only understanding of what's going on and who's doing it and what the effects might be, but some conceptual language, some like easy to picture case studies and metaphors that concretize these technologies and their risks in a way that anybody can connect to. And then once people understand that, once we are communally aware of these ever-present data systems, I really do think that we can develop new cultural practices and new forms of social organization and new forms of political organizing. And Jesse and I are working on a new book called Data Kindness, New Forms of Kindness, that will be liberatory and that will diminish the power of these technologies over our lives.
As you write at the end of the book, we can't control data, but we can understand it better. We must understand it better. I think this book did an admirable job of advancing that cause, of allowing us to understand better the data that surrounds us, the systems that make use of it, and how we can build something better in the face of that. The book is called The Secret Life of Data, Navigating Hype and Uncertainty in the Age of Algorithmic Surveillance, by you, Aram Sinreich, and Jesse Gilbert, published by MIT Press. Aram, thanks so much for being on the show, and I hope you will be back with your next book, if not before.
Thank you so much, Mark. It's great talking to somebody who gets it and feels as passionately about it as I do. Thanks for inviting me on the show.
And we're back. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host for the remaining few minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with Aram Sinreich, co-author of the book The Secret Life of Data, co-written with Jesse Gilbert, published by MIT Press. A book I liked a lot. It said a lot about the data that surrounds us and is multiplying and the systems that undergird that surveillance and analysis. I'll say it again, outside of our awareness or consent, but the book chips away a little bit at that problem of awareness. As we said at the end of the interview, the purpose, one of the main purposes of this show, as Aram said was the purpose of his book, is to raise awareness. It's so important for us to just begin to understand the systems and the economic arrangements and the power asymmetries that affect us increasingly every day of our lives. And it's not going to change until unless we get more awareness and do something about it. So thanks to Aram for coming on the show and discussing the book. And as I said before, if you're interested in a link to the book, go to tectonic.fm and find the link on the playlist page. And speaking of this, the Tectonic website, I said at the top of the show I wanted to say something about it. I have a very, to me, a very exciting, maybe to you as well, exciting announcement, and that is that we have completely redesigned and relaunched the Tectonic website. I'm really enthusiastic about where this website is right now. It is totally redesigned. The design before was just a hand-built thing that was basically a one-page site with some links, you know, in blue underlined text, and that was about it. Now we've got a Tectonic logo. There's an About page. If you scroll down on the About page, you can see a bunch of designs from past T-shirts by Greg Harrison and some funny album covers that we did a while back. If you go to the syndication page, you can see a list of all of the stations that are now broadcasting Tectonic week to week. And most excitingly to me, if you go into the episodes page, you will see that every episode now has its own dedicated page on the Tectonic website with an embedded audio player. So if you see an episode that you like, you can click into the episode, you can click the play button, and immediately start hearing that episode. And if you scroll down on the page while you're listening, you'll see the links to the guest, and if they have a book, the link to the book, and things like that. So it's a fully built out website and resource that I hope you'll find useful. I just want to say thanks to Todd Mazursky for leading the redesign and the programming. He did a great job, and I hope that we will continue to use the Tectonic website, as I said, as a resource, as a clearinghouse. Again, back to raising awareness, go into an episode on climate change and tech, and you will get resources for further reading and study. Go into an episode on surveillance, or go into an episode on generative AI. We have episodes on all of those topics, and each of those episodes, if you scroll down in the playlist, is going to have lots of links for more reading from experts in that particular field, not to mention the guest, whoever the guest is week to week. Just click the play button on the embedded player. Can you tell I'm excited? So really, I'm really happy that we have this now for this show. And if you want to write an email to me with your thoughts, you can reach me at mark@tectonic.fm. That's mark@tectonic.fm. And for today's playlist, there's a couple of pieces that I did not get to because I ran out of time again. But I'll just say very quickly, we mentioned during the interview with Aram this recent news. It came out from 404 Media, friends of ours here at Tectonic, who wrote a story on October 23, 2025, called A $60 Mod to Meta's Ray-Bans disables its privacy-protecting recording light. And as we said during the interview, the idea is Zuckerberg's surveillance glasses, branded Ray-Ban, are supposed to have this little light that turns on when you're being surveilled by the wearer of the surveillance glasses. Well, of course, there is a modification out there now, very inexpensive, that you can install that will allow the creep to photograph you and or audio record and or video record you without your knowledge or consent, because the light will not turn on when it's being recorded. So as Aram said, when you go out in public, you just have to assume from now on that you are being recorded. If anyone is around, even if nobody's around, there still could be a microphone and or camera that's installed in the urban cityscape. Even if you're on a hiking trail somewhere, you hear about surveillance cameras purely for the benefit of the park rangers, you understand, a trail cam. Surveillance cameras, even in nature. But if you live in a place like I do, a city, I live in New York City, everywhere I go, I have to just assume that someone is recording anything that I do or say. And I'm sorry that this is where we're at. I was warning about this years ago when the show started, that we could get to this point, and now here we are, thanks to Mark Zuckerberg and others. And certainly, if you're around someone who's wearing Ray-Bans, you have to assume that the Ray-Ban glasses might be the Zuckerberg surveillance glasses, and so you have to watch what you say around anyone who's wearing Ray-Bans. It's a crazy time, friends. It's really crazy, but one thing you can do is you can read Aram's book, you can gain some more awareness, you can talk to your friends about what's happening, and you can say, listen, there's now this new website where you can listen to these shows right away. Go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. There's also, on today's playlist, there's a piece from Bruce Schneier, cybersecurity expert who's a past guest. I don't have time to read through that. And also, there is a GIF link to a story from November 2nd, 2025 in The Times by Maximilian Casey called How AI Can Use Your Personal Data to Hurt Your Neighbor. And that also is very topical to what Aram and I were talking about today. As Casey writes, to safeguard ourselves from collective harm, we need to build institutions and pass laws that give people affected by AI algorithms a voice over how those algorithms are designed and what they aim to achieve. And as I think about all of these suggestions, what we need to have or what should happen, I agree. I agree 100%. And we're not yet on a trajectory where we can ask the Congress to do a better job. They're just totally stalled right now. I think we have to start a little bit upstream of that. We have to start by talking to our friends, family, neighbors, and making sure they understand what's at risk as we hurtle into this surveillance state. So please make use of the resources for today's show and for other shows at tectonic.fm. Tell your friends, let's start to knit together a community of people who are passionate about doing something about the rise of these hegemonic, toxic, unethical actors in Silicon Valley and increasingly their government partners who are able to draw on that surveillance data without proper warrants because of how the laws are structured currently. And that's about all the time I have for that today. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City and Rockland County at 91.9 FM and online at WFMU.org. Thanks to everybody who gave during our October Hellraiser in the last month. You were very generous, and I appreciate it. I want you to stay tuned for the man you can't handle, Dave Mandel, with his show. It's complicated. It's a prog rock show. It's not that complicated, actually. He's lying. No, he's a good guy. You should listen to it. And I do have some homework for you. Until next time, friends, I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. Let's go out to a song called High Score. I'll see you next time, friends.
And welcome everyone to the latest this week's installment of my radio show. It's Complicated, an hour of prog and prog adjacent music. My name is Dave Mandel. I'm here bringing this show to you every Monday evening at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Always a sheer delight and pleasure to be here playing music for you. And do I have a great show in store for you tonight? That's a question. Do I have a great show? I don't know. I may not. I'm asking you. But we're going to start it with some music from Germany. I've been playing a lot. I guess I now and then dip into what I would call proto-prog music from like the very early 70s, when the sort of bands were kind of transitioning into what would become prog rock, little bits of classical influences and so on. So we're going to hear something from that bucket right now. I'm going to play a German group. They were called 2066 and then. It's spelled out in words, 2066 and then. Obviously, the year, I guess. And in fact, they put out two albums that I know of, and we're going to hear a track from the first one, which was called Reflections on the Future. And again, heavy rock with some definite prog flourishes, prog influences, including the sort of Bach-ish organ. Anyway, we're going to hear again a track from 2066, and then we'll be hearing a track called Autumn, and this is it.
Sometimes makes me want to cry. The leaves in the trees. know that you feel it's there. Haunts of shadows start showing in the sky. And then the winter is approaching by and by. And as I walk through life, I feel the years go by. Haunts of sadness sometimes makes me want to cry. The leaves in the trees and the birds in the sky with the autumn the time of the moon. Signs in the air say that autumn is there and the winter is coming soon. In a time that you know that you're feeling bad. We'll be right back.